Thank you for having me down. And yes, the reason I'm here is primarily to reflect on my experience as a member of the Government 2.0 Task Force, which was 2009 now. So it's, in fact, 2 years ago now that the task force was operating. But its impact continues to reverberate around the jurisdictions, which is good, and in particular in our archival community. So that's what I'll be doing today. So I'll give you a bit of background as to where this thing came from and talk you through the issues that the task force deliberated upon and some of its conclusions and recommendations and what happened to those recommendations. And then at the end I'll reflect on what it means for us as records professionals. So, in the background, the task force was appointed and announced by two federal ministers, both of whom have since actually retired from the ministry, interestingly enough. One was Lindsay Tanner when he was the finance minister, and the other was John Faulkner when, I think at the time, he was the cabinet secretary, although he then became the defence minister when Joel Fitzgibbon self-destructed. So both very powerful ministers within the Rudd government at the time, both from the left faction, interestingly, but they were both very strong sponsors of the open government agenda, which was a Labor Party election platform commitment. This commitment to pro-disclosure, transparency in government, opening up the processes of government to invite in citizen engagement, to promote higher standards of integrity in public administration, etc. So one of the strands of that policy agenda was reforming freedom of information law, which also another minister, Joe Ludwig, pushed through. Joe Ludwig had been the Shadow Attorney General, and then when Faulkner moved on to defence, Joe Ludwig then became the Cabinet Secretary, so he also got involved in a lot of these processes as well. So the Freedom of Information amendments were passed through Parliament at around that time. There was also a companion piece of legislation to establish the Office of the Information Commissioner, which is a whole new function, if you like, a whole new office of government. The Office of the Information Commissioner is responsible for both FOI and privacy laws. So underneath the Information Commissioner, there's an FOI Commissioner and a Privacy Commissioner. I think you have similar arrangements in New South Wales. So that legislation was passed at around that time. And as well as amendment to the Archives Act, which changed the length of the so-called closed period from 30 years to 20 years, and that change is being phased in over a 10-year period and has already commenced. So they were major reforms that had the aim of opening up access to public sector information. One of the main model for the task force was a similar UK task force called the Power of Information Task Force, which had issued its report, I think the year before, in 2008, and that had most of its recommendations endorsed by the British government. So the terms of reference for the two task forces were quite similar. And I think the other inspiration for the task force was President Obama. Some of you might know that the very first thing that he did as president was to issue a declaration of open government. He was sworn in on the 20th of January, and on the 21st of January he issued his declaration of open government. So he really nailed his colours to the mast about, you know, this was a major policy commitment of the new administration, which set a whole lot of things in motion in the US federal government. So the policy reform being pushed by Lindsay Tanner and John Faulkner was a long-standing one, but I think it had been energised by what was happening in the UK and in the USA. So the task force was appointed, and the chair was Nicholas Gruen, who is an economist. He heads up a Melbourne-based economics consultancy firm, and also a fairly well-known blogger on whatever takes his fancy, basically public policy issues of one kind or another, often with an economic bent, but not exclusively. And I think Nicholas Gruen and Lindsay Tanner were old buddies from way back. And in fact, Lindsay Tanner, you may know, had written a book a few years ago on opening government, and I think Nicholas Gruen had helped him write that book. So that's where that came from. And there were 15 members of the task force in total. Most of them didn't come from government. Mostly they were people from outside of government, from the private sector, from universities, from the sort of voluntary sector, etc., as well as a handful of people from within government. So I was one of, I think, only 6 public officials of the 15 people on the task force, and I was the only one that had any kind of background in information management. So the terms of reference, I've summarised there on that slide, I draw your attention to with the terms of reference is that they actually say very little about technology. In fact, I don't know that technology was mentioned once anywhere, and the terms of reference were quite extensive. They went for like at least a page, maybe a page and a half, and nowhere really was the technology of Web 2.0 actually mentioned. I think the word online might have been used once or twice, and that was the closest the terms of reference actually got to mentioning anything technical. So why that's important is I think it just highlights the fact that what the task force was all about was changing the nature of governance and the nature of public administration, with technology being an enabler to that, but the technology was definitely not the focus. It was more just a backdrop. So it was all a matter of changing the orientation, the attitude, the culture of government, the way government conducts its business, the way government interacts with the community. There were really, if you looked at the terms of reference, they boiled down to 3 main issues. Firstly, how to encourage and enable more active citizen engagement in the processes of government and in policy formulation in particular. And of course the major record keeping challenges therein which were definitely recognised by the task force. Secondly, opening up access to and reuse of public sector information, very much in line with the freedom of information reforms. This phrase, public sector information, was used and was taken very much from the UK, that the phrase that's fell into common parlance in the UK, and we just sort of lifted that phrase and started using it. And one of the interesting issues we had to grapple with in the early weeks of the task force was, what do we mean by public sector information? What's in and what's out in terms of its definition? Because it can be narrowly defined or it can be broadly defined. I pushed hard for it to be broadly defined and didn't get a lot of resistance, I have to say, from within the task force. So what it meant was that it included the holdings, the collections of the institutions, including the really old historical material was included within that broad definition. And that was good because it meant then that open access to that material was in scope for the deliberations of the task force. Beyond those first two issues, then the focus was very much on identifying and overcoming the barriers to achieving those two things. And they were primarily cultural barriers, but there were also obviously some economic funding issues and a number of legal and administrative barriers that we had to identify. And I've just noted there that the barriers really weren't. The technology is there to do all of these things. The technology is an enabler, not a barrier. And we were focusing more on what were the barriers and how can we deal with them. So in the first weeks or so of the task force, the task force only existed for 6 months, actually. I got my letter of appointment in, I don't know, it was late June or early July, something like that. We had our first meeting in early July, and we were required to report by Christmas, basically 6 months, really less 6 months when you think that you've got to have the report written well ahead of your deadline to get it edited and approved and form that it can be circulated, etc. So we had less than 6 months, which was quite a punishing schedule given the broad nature of our terms of reference, and also given the fact that with the exception of Nicholas Gruen, who was working on this full time, the rest of us all had our day job. And so at the same time as doing this, I was running my usual team at National Archives and also trying to coordinate a digital archives business case, which had a similar deadline. And so it was a very busy, in fact, it was easily the busiest 6 months of my entire working life. It was a very frantic, but very exciting time. In the first week, we wrote and issued an issues paper, which was really generate discussion and wider interest in the sorts of issues we were grappling with. So we identified a range of issues, asked a whole stack of questions, and sought people's views on those issues and those questions. Structured the issues paper according to the OECD's principles for public sector information. And I've got the six or eight principles. I've got the main ones there on the slide. And I think they're really excellent rules. I'd certainly commend them to you. And they were an excellent frame of reference for our issues paper. And in particular, what's interesting from our perspective is the third and fourth dot points I've got there, ensuring quality and integrity of information and long-term preservation of information. I thought it was very encouraging that the OECD acknowledged those issues in their principles, and it was really the fact that the task force decided to use the principles to frame its issues paper meant that gave me quite a lot of scope for getting our sorts of issues onto the agenda at that early stage of the task force. So that was encouraging. When you go through the issues paper, then underneath the OECD principles, there are a range of matters that we canvassed. Obviously, the cultural one was of key importance, how to foster that culture of openness and online engagement, because they're things that are deeply counterintuitive for most public servants, and we recognised that early on within the task force. We also recognised that although we had some high-level political champions for what we were doing, we were not naive enough to be aware of the fact that there were going to be winners and losers in this exercise, and that there were some seriously powerful entrenched interests who were going to find our work somewhat threatening and unsettling, and that they wouldn't necessarily openly oppose us because, you know, we were flavour of the month, but we knew that behind the scenes we'd get a lot of surreptitious opposition, and we have to be very mindful of that. Open licensing regimes, most prominent of those being Creative Commons. Of course, we canvassed that quite widely in the issues paper. We gave a guernsey to the semantic web, or Web 3.0 as it's sometimes called, which gave me an opportunity to say a few things about metadata in the issues paper. So I got the M word in there, which was nice. The importance of open standards and open data formats, obviously big issues about managing openness, but at the same time balancing it against legitimate privacy and security concerns and how to risk manage those. Record-keeping challenges were acknowledged up front, and also the need to reform copyright administration in the Australian government. While the task force was deliberating, we also had a bit of money thrown our way by AGIMO, AGIMO is the Australian Government Information Management Office. AGIMO provided the task force secretary. It supported all the administrative side of our operations. And so AGIMO owed us some money to sponsor and pay for a range of projects. So we crowdsourced our suggestions for projects over our blog site, and we got a whole stack of interesting suggestions back about what kind of projects could be sponsored. We ended up sponsoring, I think it was about 18 different projects, and all of them had to go to tender, because it was public money we were spending, so we had to be squeaky clean about procurement, and then we had to assess the responses to the tenders, select suitable contractors to do the project, sign contracts with them, and then work with them to actually do their work. So by the time, in fact, the contracts were signed with the successful tenderers and they actually started working, it was September pretty much, and the projects were meant to be completed by early December. Now that was very difficult and in fact proved to be impossible in a lot of cases. And that was unfortunate because we wanted the results of the projects to inform our final report, but in a lot of cases that simply wasn't possible given the timeframes. But a couple of them did, and in fact, interestingly, one of the projects that we engaged was Dagmar Pera and Eric Wainwright were engaged to look at the whole of government information publication scheme and how that would work. And they were the last consultants to have their contract signed, and they were the first to deliver their reports. So they were exemplary and extremely efficient in how they how they did their work. And because they got their report in early, in fact, large chunks of their report then were echoed in the overall task force report, which was nice. Wasn't so easy in most of the other cases. But there's some really interesting projects, and the project reports, I think, are a resource as well that are still on the website for the Gov2 task force, and I'd commend many of them to you. So there was one, the first one there is the economic value of public sector information for cultural institutions. That was done by a University of Queensland economist by the name of John Quiggin. He's an internationally renowned economist, and he looked hard at how do you justify, in economic terms, opening up the holdings of cultural institutions for reuse under this kind of rubric. And he demonstrated that, yes, there is an economic payback in doing this. So I think that's useful if you're talking to Treasury officials about a lot of our sort of stuff. His report's actually quite useful. There's a report on enhancing the discoverability and accessibility of public sector information, which looked a lot at, not surprisingly, metadata issues. There's another report on early leadership in the semantic web, who's doing what around the place in terms of taking advantage of the semantic web. There's a report on identifying the barriers to Web 2 take-up in agencies. There's Dagmar and Eric's report that I've already mentioned. There's a report on copyright and intellectual property issues that was done by a lady called Anne Fitzgerald at Queensland University of Technology. She's an IP professor up at QUT. A report on online engagement guidance and a Web2 toolkit. Barbara Reid was engaged to do a project report on the preservation of Web2 content and record keeping issues. Barbara did an excellent report, which is on the web. Unfortunately, it didn't come in time for us to reflect it in the final task force report, but it's nevertheless a good project report. And then there was a report on Gov2.0 governance and institutions. In other words, how ought the Australian government carry the agenda forward once the task force went out of existence, and who's going to be responsible for making things happen. Different members of the task force were earmarked to mentor different projects, and so I mentored three or four different projects, as well as being, a member of the task force deliberations in the mainstream. I was also busy interacting with various of the consultants who are doing the different projects. But projects aspect of the work of the task force is something that's not well recognised. I think a lot of really good work was done in these projects, and I definitely would recommend that you have a look at some of those project reports. Also early on in the life of the task force, we latched on to these three laws of open government data that a Canadian blogger called David Eves had blogged, and it, in many respects it sums up what we're on about very nicely in three fairly pithy statements. First being, if it can't be spidered or indexed, it doesn't exist. Second is, if it isn't available in open and machine readable format, it can't engage. And the third is, if a legal framework doesn't allow it to be repurposed, then it doesn't empower. There's a lot of words that came out of the work of the task force, but those three laws of open government are always worth going back to. Okay, so we worked really hard, went through innumerable drafts of our final report, and eventually it was issued, and it was handed over to the two ministers on the 23rd of December 2009. So we just made it, and of course it was made available on the web pretty much simultaneously with that. We made a number of recommendations. The ones that are of particular interest to us as archivists, I think, recommendation 6, that public sector information should be made open, accessible and reusable. Recommendation 7 focused a lot on copyright issues. It talked about reform to the Orphan Works provision of the Copyright Act, which is a particular barrier for institutions such as ours, and also copyright administration within the Commonwealth, which had been administered by a bunch of extremely conservative lawyers in the Attorney General's Department, and we made some recommendations about how that could be made less risk-averse, if you like. Recommendation 8 was on how the information publication scheme might operate under the auspices of the Information Commissioner. And recommendation 12 was all about the record-keeping issues specifically. The task force effectively just told me to go away and write that recommendation, so that was a nice feeling of power to have that. The title of the recommendation, though, I must say, wasn't mine. That was I don't know, a sub-editor came up with that. Because the definition of a Commonwealth record was certainly one of the issues that was alluded to in the recommendation, but it was by no means the entirety of the recommendation. The recommendation was really in two or three parts. One was looking at the issue of how should the Commonwealth manage the records of its activities that are enabled through the use of third-party social networking sites. And the second part of the recommendation was really just reiterating the need for agencies to use endorsed records and information management standards when they're operating in a Web 2 environment and to try and get another mandate, if you like, for agencies to comply with the standards and guidelines issued by the National Archives and by other standard-setting bodies. The recommendations were all endorsed by the government with one or two minor exceptions. There were only 1.5 recommendations that weren't endorsed. There's a recommendation about establishing a scheme for what Nicholas Gruen called info philanthropy, whereby people could get taxation breaks by making information, putting information into the public domain, if you like. Treasury were a bit alarmed by the fiscal implications of that recommendation, so that wasn't supported. And the other half of the recommendation that wasn't supported was because the task force had been frustrated by the level of opposition we got from the lawyers in the Attorney General's Department about the Commonwealth Copyright Administration, we put in a recommendation that function should be taken away from the Attorney General's Department and given to someone else. In the process of the government considering its response to our recommendations, Attorney General's fought a fierce rearguard action and managed to get that recommendation overturned. But we lost that particular battle, but I think we won the war because, in effect, Commonwealth Copyright Administration has been completely overturned, and the Attorney General's Department has had to come kicking and screaming to the party here. So there's been an interesting kind of cultural turnaround there. I think the overall impact has been quite stunning, really. I mean, at around the time we issued our report, there was Ken Henry's report into reform of the taxation system, you might recall that, which I'm not sure, can't remember how many recommendations were in his report, but next to none of them were endorsed by the government. So in that context, for us to get almost all of our recommendations endorsed was good going, actually, because it's not at all uncommon for, committees of inquiry and task forces, etc., to be set up and raise people's expectations, only then for the recommendations not to be accepted by the government, and then the report just gathers dust. Effectively, all of our recommendations were endorsed, all of the important ones were endorsed, and that was extremely encouraging. So why does it matter to us? For Government 2.0 to work, it needs content, and it needs content in context. Now, a lot of the Web 2 practitioners won't necessarily understand that, but we understand it, and we've got a lot of content in our collections which is just waiting to be liberated and used for public good purposes. But for this to happen, the information's got to be managed professionally. Public sector agencies have to know what public sector information they've got, and they have to manage that information professionally and dispose of it according to relevant disposal authorizations, etc., etc. So our work is a prerequisite for successful Gov2, if you like, and that was very much recognised by the work of the task force. There's also recognition that our skills are terribly important in that context, and our core skills in terms of authenticity, integrity, contextualisation, and resource discovery are vitally important and arguably have been undervalued and under-recognised for too long, but there's a new dawn, which I think is very exciting for us. Is it a brave new world, or is it just hype, or is it the end of the world, as we know, if you want to be particularly pessimistic about things? Because it certainly it is a game changer, and if you're doggedly attached to traditional old-fashioned notions of what an archival institution does, then you might find this stuff quite unsettling, because you know, it's all about being open and engaged and interactive and collaborative. And if you can allow me to engage in some sweeping generalizations, traditional archives are often seen as being very closed, authoritarian, users are mistrusted, access is an afterthought at best. I'm exaggerating here, but you know, you can see aspects of that in traditional archival operations, and so this is a whole new kind of mindset and a whole new way of conceptualizing the business of archives. So potentially there is a bit of a culture clash there, but it's no different to the culture clash that the task force identified with public servants more generally. You know, that we're talking about a whole different paradigm here, and you're not going to get there overnight, and it is a major cultural and attitudinal and philosophical shift that we all have to undertake. But if we don't seize that new paradigm and cling too desperately to traditional mindsets, then we're going to become irrelevant. Eric Kettler, one of the things we did with the task force was we set up an international reference group of experts. So it included people like Tim Berners-Lee, for example. Eric Kettler was one of those. And that was because Eric was involved in a similar initiative in the Netherlands called Civil Servant 2.0, and some of you might have seen the report that's come out of that initiative, which is also an interesting read. And Eric was in Melbourne during the work of the task force. He's a visiting professor at Monash University. So he and Nicholas Gruen caught up for lunch one day, and Eric actually spoke to the task force by video conference for one of our meetings. So that was great for me, because it meant that there was another record-keeping voice that the members of the task force could hear from, not just me all the time. And Eric was very eloquent, of course, as you would expect. And he was very terribly excited about the whole thing. And his view was, it's obviously not the end of the world as we know it. In fact, this could be the making of us. Archives 2.0 and Government 2.0, because it'll allow us to do a whole lot of the things that maybe we've always wanted to do but always struggled with, in terms of opening up access, promoting use and appreciation of archival resources, and just recognising the dynamic nature of record making and record keeping, and the fact that everyone's a record keeper, everyone's got stories to tell and preserve, and that, you know, everyone can be an archivist and everyone can join into the archival endeavour, if you like, through these more open and interactive systems. The other thing I think that's important is that in other countries it's been a great strategic opportunity for archival institutions. So in the United Kingdom, the Office of Public Sector Information, which administers copyright and licensing for UK government information, is not located within their equivalent of the Attorney General's Department. It's actually located within the National Archives. So Carol Tuller, who's the head of the Office of Public Sector Information, who's a lawyer, an IP lawyer, she's actually a division head within the UK National Archives. So I think that's very strategically useful for TNA to have that role within the British government. And similarly in the USA, with their under Obama's FOI reforms in that government, although the US has had freedom of information laws for a long time, they've never actually had anyone responsible for oversighting those laws. So Obama appointed an Office of Government Information Services, and he brought back from Paris, a woman who had previously been head of the American Library Association, but who had been working in UNESCO, to head up the Office of Government Information Services. She's a woman called Miriam Nesbitt. And lo and behold, the Office of Government Information Services was created as a division within the U.S. National Archives and Records Administration. So she reports to the U.S. National Archivist as well as reporting directly to the White House. So I think for archival institutions, in terms of our strategic positioning, you know, it's clear that this policy reform agenda provides opportunities that can help us reinvent ourselves as not just the keeper of interesting old stuff, but as institutions with a vital role to play in current waves of policy reform in government, and a chance to apply our core skills to those issues. I mentioned earlier that the Gov2 Task Force maintained a blog site. All of the members of the task force were strongly encouraged to post blogs to that blog site. So I posted two, one each on the two main issues as I saw them from our perspective. And so the first one was on how Government 2.0 could help us liberate the content of heritage collections through digitisation, through open licensing, through crowdsourcing user contributed content, allowing for archival mashup, better engagement with our user communities, at the same time as, you know, obviously managing privacy issues, and also reflecting on this issue of, well, what does this mean for us? Does it mean that we're losing control of our collections by handing them over to the wider community, or is it a process of building value through collaboration? And I think you can guess which side of that argument I came down on. And I also mentioned, of course, the long-standing interesting issue of whether we ought to be crowdsourcing some of our appraisal decisions or not. The second post I put on the Task Force blog was looking more at the record keeping issues associated with Government 2.0. How can we face up to the challenges of good records and information management in a Web2 world? Is there the notion of an original record still a useful one in that context or not? How can we reassert some of our first principles but at the same time completely change many of our practices and mindsets? And in that context, reasserting the need that, well, you've got to understand your record keeping requirements and who's responsible for meeting those requirements. And these are first principles, and how the use of things like open standard are important for managing technological obsolescence. So all the posts on our blog were Creative Commons, of course, so they were in fact repurposed widely, which was good. For example, there's a newspaper that you might see called Public Service News or Public Sector News, that they in effect syndicated my blogs under Creative Commons. I didn't realise that they'd done that. So then I people started emailing me and saying, I really liked your article in PS News. And what article? It turned out it was my blog post. So that was good. It meant that it spread the news more widely and got a whole lot more people reading and thinking about this stuff. To finish off, it's a challenging and exciting time. It's up to us to rise to the challenge, I think, not shrink away from it. It certainly, I think, raises the expectations of our user community, and if we don't meet those raised expectations, we do risk becoming irrelevant. So it's exciting but challenging at the same time. But we've got the skills, and they are unique skills in many respects, to embrace this new world and to really take advantage of it and to march into this exciting new era. So we hold the keys to unlocking the latent information wealth of the nation. Are we brave enough to use those keys or not? And as a final question, which maybe can open up some discussion, if we go back to Hillary Jenkinson and the physical and moral defence of the record, which is, according to Jenkinson, our primary mission, is that still a valid archival mission in the age of Archives 2.0? And I'd be interested to hear people's thoughts about that.